Next case, 98403, Sheet Metal Workers International Association versus Mohawk Mechanical.
Indicates the work that the interested party must be authorized in doesn't indicate whether it's oral or written. The sheet metal workers obtain oral authorization of the employee, which is subsequently confirmed in writing.
And we'll find that in the record, will we, that there was there an affidavit or testimony somehow that indicates there was verbal authorization?
The record is silent on that matter because we never had a hearing or any proceedings in the court of common pleas. The record is clear, though, that the written authorization was submitted. And if you read the statute, and I know you have, Your Honor, it indicates that an interested party must file an administrative complaint. And 60 days of the, in this situation, the High Department of Industrial Relations, now the OPDS, if it doesn't take any action, an interested party may proceed in common pleas court. The authorization, the first written authorization, was 60 days prior to the filing of the complaint in the Knox County Police Court. That is clear with the record. That authorization was submitted, and it was not disputed that that authorization was prior to the 60 days.
So why does the verbal thing have any effect at all?
If, Your Honor, doesn't need to be the authorization, if the court was determined, could be oral, but there was a written authorization that fulfilled that request.
Well, it may be relevant if this is a statutory scheme, is it not? You can't send the... Can the disgruntled person go directly to common pleas court? Don't they have to go through the administrative system first?
There is a three.
That has to be filed by somebody.
Correct. And then, Your Honor, there are three ways that the statute can be enforced: by the individual, by the state, or by an interested party. In this situation, the interested party enforced the statute.
That gets us back to the authorization. I guess I agree with you, and you're baiting the law. I guess I'm agreeing with you, but factually, I'm wondering whether that we have a record that says, that reveals that when the first document that sets into motion the complaint process,
yes.
whether there was written authorization for the union to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, there is. As part of the record, the sheet metal workers filed in the common pleas court with an affidavit, the written authorization of the employee, who Mohawk admits, and it's presented part of the case, that these were employees who in fact worked on the public improvement. That is not in dispute. The written authorizations were submitted. The first one was 60 days prior to the filing of the complaint. There were ones subsequently, but 03 indicates that once you become an interested party for a particular public improvement, you're the interested party on the entire project.
All right, so all that authorization brings us to the issue. Are they an interested party by virtue of the assignment?
And they're interested.
And if they're an interested party, don't you have to be privy to the contract itself,
Your Honor,
to be an interested party?
You do not have. The legislature does not make that as a requirement. The Court of Appeals has read that in. But I ask you, Your Honor, if they can't collect a bargaining agreement, there are contractual remedies. They could have filed a grievance if the employees weren't paid the proper wage. They could have proceeded to arbitration. That's why the statute allows an interested party who is authorized by the employees to proceed in this remedy. There is no requirement in the statute for a collective bargaining agreement. This court stated in State versus Stevens, a court is not permitted to read words into or out of the statute, but must accept the enactment of the General Assembly as it stands. With all due respect to the Court of Appeals, in two occasions, it read into the statute requirements which are not in it.
So you don't have to be a bidder or anybody connected with it. You're saying an interested party is somebody who can be aggrieved, as opposed to somebody who initiated the contract.
An employee who's aggrieved in pursuing, in this situation, a bidder is needed. We recognize that, and under F1, it indicates that any person who submits a bid for the purpose of securing a contract for construction that is what American standard is. There is no question. The Black Law Dictionary defines this as what American standard is. It then in turn subcontracted that to Mohawk, which meets the requirement in F2, and then it sets the statutory fee for the sheet metal workers to fulfill the requirements of F3 as an interested party. In the Bandleaf case, that the provision of Chapter 4115 must be remedied, irrespective of if an affected worker chooses not to act. As long as individuals provide the authorization, in this case they did, then as an interested party, they can proceed on behalf of all of the employees. It's a remedial statute allowing an interested party to pursue the remedies on behalf of everyone on that particular statute. And for that reason, Your Honor, in order for this court to fulfill the court's statement in Evans versus Moore, that the Ohio Prevention Rate Statutes provide a comprehensive, uniform framework for worker rights and remedies. To fulfill that, we respectfully ask you to reverse the court of appeals.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Holy Counsel, the court may please report. I'm Dave Carto, counsel for the Appalachian Mohawk Mechanical Team. I think that at the outset we need to make sure that we understand what the issue is that is before this court. And both the amicus and the appellant in this case spend a lot of time and paper arguing that Mohawk Mechanical has violated the prevailing wage law. There is no such finding anywhere in this record. And Mohawk Mechanical has never admitted that it violated any prevailing wage law. That issue was never addressed. It was never reached by either the trial court in this case or the court of appeal. Does Mohawk acknowledge prevailing wage law should be in effect with respect to construction? Your Honor, again, that issue was not reached. That would possibly be an issue. Maybe that is in dispute. Yes, that is in dispute.
I thought they accepted that proposition. It was clearly a public project, and that they knew the prevailing wage. In fact, they talked about it.
I think we can probably agree that it was a public improvement project. However, as you point out, under 16.372, I believe, is the statute. This 3313, excuse me, 372. This project was exempt from competitive bidding. Now, there's some argument, and there is some dispute in the record over whether or not exemption from competitive bidding also exempted it from prevailing wage.
But didn't they discuss with the general contractor, and they had the discussions between them? They knew that it was a public project. They knew the prevailing wage had to be paid.
That is disputed in the record below. Mohawk people never agreed with that assertion by American Standard. Our interrogatory answered by American Standard asserted that Mohawk people denied that. Are we required to determine whether the
general contractor
has been from the prevailing wage?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Although, as you noted, in our merit brief, we do spend a good deal of time talking about the policy behind the prevailing wage laws.
We raise that because we think that's important to understand the statutory construction in this case and what the statutory scheme is. And again, getting back to that,
The issue is not whether Mohawk was subject to the prevailing wage law, whether that was applied in this case or whether they violated it. The first and only issue that was decided was the Local 33 did not have standing as an interested party, strictly a matter of statutory construction. So when we address that issue, obviously we go down to the statute. We do dispute that American Standard and Mohawk were, whether or not they were business. We deny, since this was not a competitive bid project, that Mohawk or American Standard were quote-unquote bidders.
So that's the point that I wanted to pursue, because it seems to me it's an important point. The one of the Street gives us the definition of bid. Black's Law Dictionary, which is certainly more general than competitive. I guess the General Assembly knows how to restrict terms if it wants to. That bid is a term of art, I would guess. It didn't say competitive bid, and so I guess I'm wondering, what is a bid? I mean, what was the document? How did Mohawk get the job here? They had to submit something, costs and...
Mohawk did submit a proposal after being asked to submit one by American Standard for the work they wanted done. And they did so, it was accepted. It was not competitively bid. In other words, the owner of the project did not open this up for bid to anybody, whether subcontractors or general.
But the owner wants to know, certainly, a lot of specifications. He wants to know, what's going to cost to have Mohawk, or the owner, the general contractor, the owner wants to know all the things, I would guess, that you have in a competitive bid. Is that not correct? Is it
actually the owner in this project, as I understand it, would be contracting with American Standard, yeah, and accept a price there, and American Standard find somebody to do the work they need to be done. So it's not really involved directly with John's career. It gets back again, I think, to the policy too, and that is why the prevailing wage law and the policy behind it is, as this court stated in Evans v. Moore, was that to support the integrity of the collective bargaining process by preventing the undercutting of wages. The collective bargaining process is not involved nor effective in this case. Local 33 was not a party to any collective bargaining agreement with anybody in this project. Didn't have any members of the union either employed by either of the contractors or subcontractors, did not have any members working on the project. Those two items, I think, sufficiently distinguish this case from the Johnson Controls case, which was cited by the
judge. The prevailing wage applies. It doesn't matter if it's employed or not. The contractor did that today, whoever did the work, prevailing wage.
As the subcontractor?
Yes.
If the prevailing wage laws apply, I have to be acknowledged that the subcontractor would have to pay prevailing wage. Now, there's some other issues about that.
They're respecting the affiliation of the employee.
That's the effect of the law. It doesn't only apply to unions, but I'm going to try to leave some time for amicus in this matter, Your Honor. I'll just point out one matter, also statutory construction. You have to read this statute in the context in which it's written. There is no point or intent apparent in this thing that the General Assembly intended labor organizations to be able to come in and represent anybody for any reason. If Mohawk is a bidder under F1, as is argued by the appellant, then F2 doesn't have any reason for existence. Because if that's the case, every subcontractor that is in F2 would also be F1. And of course, the court has said many a time, if you read a statute, so it should give effect to all parts of it. I'd like to reserve them as my time for amicus.
Just one more question before you sit down, sir, because this question catches me by surprise, really, the issue of whether or not Mohawk knew. I know you go through that on pages 1, 2, and 3 of your brief that you deny that Mohawk knew, but when I looked at American Standard's answers to the interrogatories, they specifically said that Mohawk told them that Mohawk's bid was based, the proposal was based on the prevailing wages. And in addition to that, you even requested their prevailing wage rate classification. Is that not true?
Your Honor, if you look at the request, the rest of the discovery in the case, Mohawk people dispute that. They deny that that happened. In fact, they would assert, although again, this is not part of the issue before the court, that not only did that not happen, not only did those conversations not take place, but Knox Career Center itself, the owner of the project, thought they were exempt from prevailing wage. And that's why they didn't appoint a prevailing wage coordinator, didn't post prevailing wage rates, and comply with any of the other things you want to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Baker.
General. Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Brian Chayton. I represent the Municipal Highway Committee. In addition to the arguments made by Mr. Carter, there are a number of other hurdles that the town of Local 30 pretty much overcome before it can attain interested party status and therefore count the standing to file a complaint with the Ohio Administrative Agency covering this law and thereafter bring a complaint to town of Cleveland. Both of those reforms I'm going to talk about come straight out of the statute, 41503F3. Under that statute, two requirements I'm going to talk about are first, that Local 33 be, quote, authorized to represent, and two, that they be authorized to represent employees. First, with regard to the authorized to represent, due to the timing of the claims authorization that was signed by the people that actually work on the project, Local 33 fails, those authorizations fail to qualify Local 33 as a nuisance party. It's undisputed that the prevailing wage complaint filed by Local 33 with the Ohio Department of Industrial Relations was filed on September 18, 1995. As of September 18, 1995, none of those written authorization forms were signed. There is no other evidence in the record established that anyone authorized Local 33 to do anything on the behalf aside from the signing of those authorization forms. So even if you accept Local 33's other arguments, Local 33 was not authorized to represent anybody on September 18, 1995, and therefore had no standing to file a prevailing wage complaint with the Ohio Department of Industrial Relations. Then, 4115.16b says only the interested party that filed a prevailing wage complaint with the department is allowed to, if they're unsatisfied with the action taken by the department, allowed to file an action in town of Cleveland Court. Local 33 doesn't qualify, doesn't have standing, doesn't qualify to meet this party because of the timing of those authorizations. Second, the claimed authorizations that Local 33 obtained in this case don't authorize Local 33 to represent the person within the meaning of those terms within that period of statute. The authorization procured by Local 33 after it filed the prevailing wage complaint purports to authorize Local 33 to represent them, quote, in all manners pertaining to claims regarding prevailing wage payments. Now, F3 contemplates something much more than this in order to be authorized to represent somebody to file a prevailing wage complaint under the act. It means that as the Court of Appeals recognized that the local union be authorized to represent for purposes of collective bargaining. Now, the appellant is simply through what the Court of Appeals said is saying that there is required there to be a collective bargaining agreement in effect. That's not what the Court of Appeals says, and that's not the requirement. The language of the statute quite clearly contemplates there may be two different types of scenarios. When a company has collective bargaining obligations with a labor organization, it's very possible that they're in the process of bargaining, they haven't started bargaining yet, for whatever reason they haven't come to a contract. So the state recognizes that in close proximity, if there are members, there is a collective bargaining agreement in place, there will be members of that contract. If there's no collective bargaining agreement in place, but there's still a collective bargaining obligation relationship, then the union will be fully authorized to represent those individuals for many purposes, including they all have a common interest, they've authorized them, they've voted, they've signed authorization cards, is that term of art with regard to labor law, to have the union represent them for a variety. In fact, Reed points out the fact that in the labor law, part of authorization is a very specific term of art. There are numerous cases in the Management Relations Board that construe the term authorized as being authorized to represent for collective bargaining purposes. And that's given the timing, especially of the adoption of this law in 1931, and the timing of the Notice of Warranty Act, which first gave protection to individuals who constantly bargained with their employers in 1932, that type of language, that the meaning of that term has been used today.
So you don't, I guess you just gave the answer. You don't believe that the word authorized in F3 could be used to, or could be support for authors, could be support for persons who are not represented by the union, requesting the union to represent them for a specific purpose, such as negotiating the wage that the employees are being paid. That authorized to you means, you're arguing, I guess that authorized means the bigger scope of union authorization to represent employees on the collective bargaining sorts of issues or the specific issues. That's not for saying very clearly, but that's...
My point is that the statute, I think, quite clearly says that authorized to represent has to be authorized to represent for purposes of collective bargaining. And if that happens, then yes, the union has the is properly raised for them. Otherwise, they don't. And that definitely is borne out even further by the fact that suppose Local 33 has gotten an authorization from any employee to represent them in workers' compensation. Local 33, under the argument they made, would be allowed to then call off and file a prevailing wage complaint with the Ohio Workers' Compensation Service. I don't think that's contemplated by the statute.
Could they represent them in the workers' comp plan?
Sure.
So that's not collective bargaining, is it?
That's right, but that's not what this statute says. This statute says they have to be authorized to represent, and the meaning is for purposes of collective bargaining.
Okay, under this language, could the union represent a person, not a member? One of the persons here who went, complained about their own. Could the union represent them in a workers' comp plan?
Yeah, that would be up to the workers' comp plan. The answer is yes. I have to be familiar with that.
But that's not collective bargaining.
We're talking about
what the word authorized means, and you're saying the word authorized means collective bargain, that the union is authorized to collectively bargain with the employer. And I'm asking you, well, what if an employee comes to the union and says, I'd like you to represent, I have a workers' comp claim, and I don't know Mr. Jaffe, so I'm going to go, I want to have you represent me. You're saying under this language, the union could represent the person in workers' comp?
That'll be under a different language. Workers' comp law would say, hey, anybody who authorized to be an attorney to appear in administrative proceedings, workers' comp law would say, that's right, anybody, you can authorize your brother-in-law or whoever you want to come in before us. But that's what happens in this case. With regard to the invalidity of the authorizations on their face, plain and simple, these authorizations are read objectively. They purport to authorize Local 33 to engage in the practice of law. Local 33 is not a licensed attorney. Local 33 cannot therefore represent these people as that phrase is used, even in the authorization, invalid void. They can't be used for purposes of giving Local 33 insurance party status.
You have used your time. Goodman, you have a little over about 10 and a half minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Court, please. What I would like to do is to address some of the questions from the bench. And the first thing I would ask the Court to take a look at is the supplement, which is part of the record of the case, and which are at the Court, page 31, 32, and 33 of the supplement, which happens to be the pointed out that the Court would again look at various pages in the supplement to get decision in the lower court, they admit they didn't pay the prevailing wage. If you look at page 5 and 43 and 44 of the supplement, which are the answers that Mohawk gave to the request for admissions to carry over to pages 44 and 45, in all those pages, which are part of the record, part of the admissions by counsel on behalf of his client, they admit they didn't follow the prevailing wage. And more importantly, or just as importantly, this court's opinion in Ohio Asphalt Station says that it is the contractor's duty. It is the contractor's duty to figure out whether or not it is a prevailing wage job. And if it is, can the public authority or the contractor to which the subcontractor is stipulated.
Yes,
thank you, Your Honor. The statute does provide that on particular public improvement, any person who submits a bid, if you look at the record, Justice Strapp, at pages 10, 16, and 22 of the supplement, you will find the proposals. They are bid. Well, first of all, Your Honor, I would say that the court should look at the assignments of error in the court of appeal and I'll answer your question. There are cases 6A and 7A of the supplement in our brief. This is unauthorized correction of law issues not raised in the trial court, not raised in the court of appeals. It is raised by an amicus who is here standing to support Mohawk. Mohawk has never raised it. Having said that, it's not Local 33. It's counsel for Local 33. It's Mr. Olada, who ultimately filed a complaint in the counseling court of Knox County. There is no requirement that I know of which says that Local 33 on behalf of the affected employees could not take a piece of paper and file a claim with the Ohio Bureau of Employment Services to start the process.
So your best response is
the attorney filed the complaint in the Knox County Counseling Court. They filed on behalf of his client. The client is Local 33.
Mr. Goodman, let me just stop you. Just a procedural matter. I gave you the wrong amount of time you had remaining. Your white light's on because your red light's now on because your time is expired. I'll let you go a little longer, but I had the wrong information. Much time you had left.
I would think to add the words that the Chief Justice Boyd was saying in the argument beforehand, to add the word competitive to the statute that doesn't use the word competitive, and to misconstrue and delete the word and in paragraph F3, which says a bona fide organization of labor, Mohawk is admitted, obviously, to Local 33 is, authorized as undefined, therefore, given the meaning that is given by the Adams County Court of Appeals, which is an act of delegation of rights, the employees in this case did, in fact, authorize Local 33 to file a claim, and it goes on to say, and which exists in whole or part for the purpose of negotiating with employers. Now, if it meant the employers that are specified in F1 and F2, it would have said negotiating with a person mentioned in F1 or F2. It just says for the purposes of negotiating with employers. Clearly, Local 33 is such a person.
Yes, argument. It's strong because the written authorization is not assumed prior to the filing. You can't prove who's drafting the answer.
Let's just talk about what I would suggest again. The record is, as Mr. Olada asserts, the issue was never raised before the trial court. Therefore, he has represented the court with an oral authorization. There's no requirement of written authorization. In any event, this court's opinion in that will simplify. I believe by Justice Cook that there's no statute of limitations. Clearly, if you only use the written authorization of September the 18th, 1995, it's clearly 90 days or 60 days before the complaint is filed to counseling court. If there's no statute of limitations, other than the one that Justice Sayward pointed out in that single slide, which is 60 days after determination, there was an authorization. It was the authorization, Bandit says you're to enforce the statute, notwithstanding that there may be some employees who don't want it enforced. Public policy of the state to enforce it, and it should be enforced. And we think that a careful reading of a remedial statute, which should be liberally construed to carry out the legislative intent, which is violators of the federal wage law, should be punished by the civil penalties contained in the statute.
Give you your time. Good.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of the opinion of the marshal. Please report.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Salt and Session. The Office of Supreme Court of Ohio. Now.